So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardawar. Trillin Low is off this week trying to stay sane during the pandemic, but I've brought on a fun guest, Anthony Ha from TechCrunch. Hey, Anthony, what's up?
You know, everything is totally normal here in New York. Everything, it's just chill and relaxed and great.
Yeah, I haven't actually seen you in person for a while, so it's good to see you over video chat as we're recording this episode. And just so you all know, TechCrunch is kind of a sister site to Engadget. I'm not sure everybody is aware of that, but we're all owned by Verizon. We all kind of do the same thing. We're all in the same offices. So I see Anthony when we're actually in the office. But
although not as often as I would have expected. Yeah. I think we sort of see each other and wave at each other in the distance.
Yeah.
But don't hang out in person as much as I would like.
For our listeners, I've worked with Anthony quite a bit. He's a super cool guy. Also, one of my many nemesis, I don't know, which includes Sherlyn. So we're going to be talking about Quibi, which is the mobile video startup founded by Jeffrey Katzenberg. You've probably seen my review floating around. It's probably the angriest thing I've written in a while because it makes me very angry. We'll have a quick conversation about that. And later on in the episode, we'll also have my interview with Alex Garland, the creator of Devs and the director of many films like Ex Machina and Annihilation. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please subscribe to the Engadget Podcast on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Please leave us a review. Reviews are really helpful. And yeah, got to fight some of those negative reviews, please. So, Anthony, do you Quibi? What is Quibi?
Wow, there's so much to unpack there. So Quibi, for those of you who are sort of, I mean, I still have this very vivid memory at CES of this older advertising executive sitting next to me at a Starbucks and just sort of loudly saying, "What is this Quibi thing I keep hearing about?" And I imagine there's still people in the world who feel that way. So it's basically a short form video app specifically for your phone. In fact, only for your phone right now. It's all shows and quote-unquote movies and chapters that are 10 minutes or less. Most of the segments, I think, are in the 5 to 8 minute range.
Yeah.
And I think it's gotten a lot of attention because it's raised a lot of money, $1.75 billion, and because it's founded by Jeffrey Katzenberg, who's this legendary Hollywood executive, and the CEO is Meg Whitman.
Yeah. Founded DreamWorks Pictures. He has been behind many, many movies. And then, yeah, Meg Whitman. Did you get to talk with those folks at CES? Because I did a sit-down interview, and it was a weird experience, right? Because I sat down and talked with Katzenberg and Meg Whitman before I even saw a demo of the app. I didn't even have a clear idea of what Quibi was. So not the best place to start with an interview, but we put that in the podcast feed. Listeners can go back and take a listen to that. It didn't seem like they had a clear idea of what they were trying to do other than mobile video seems big. Kids are on their phones. Let's put video on phones, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because I did not do the interview at CES. My colleague Sarah Perez did. But one of the things she and I had talked about beforehand and that she asked them about was when you think about mobile video, there's so much online already. It's not necessarily mobile specific, which is the point that Katzenberg and Whitman will emphasize. But there's a lot of free video online. People are watching it on their phones. Why are they going to pay for an app of this short form video? And what Meg Whitman said to Sarah was, not taking anything away from YouTube. YouTube is amazing. On YouTube, the creators there maybe spend hundreds of dollars per minute on their content. On Quibi, we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars per minute on our content.
Because that's what determines the quality of the content, is
right,
the
exactly.
money you're putting behind it, right? Like, to me, I think that is the fundamental disconnect with Quibi. Like, I'm watching a lot of these shows trapped on my phones, and they look really good. They look really high budget. They have a lot of, creative talent. They have a lot of stars and notable names. I was watching Chrissy Teigen's Court show, and it looks better than any, like, court TV show on the air right now, like better than People's Court, better than Judge Judy, but it's also not that interesting. It's not that funny. And it's a weird, like, party-like atmosphere where they bring on these people for really low-stakes issues. And it just seems like they just want to be on camera with Chrissy Teigen. It doesn't seem like anybody's trying to solve anything or accomplish anything.
I actually enjoy that because I'm somebody in general who has a lot of problem with, particularly on reality shows. I get cringy very fast when there's conflict. And so I really enjoy low stakes reality television. So in that sense, I appreciate it. I don't know if other people feel the same way. I would say that the content in general, there's this weird division for me where there are certain kinds of shows that it makes sense that they're short and on your phone, like Chrissy's Court, like The New Punked. Because I think reality TV in general has a lot of fat in it, a lot, and just needs to be, you know, the fact that it's being compressed into these really short episodes is great. You don't necessarily need to watch it on a bigger screen. The downside is, like, none of this is essential viewing for me. None of this is something that I would pay for. And then on the other hand, you have the scripted shows, some of which are promising. I think, like, Most Dangerous Game seems interesting. Flipped, which is the Will Forte comedy, I think is, like, promising. And so, like, those are the shows I'm more interested in. But in that case, it feels more frustrating that it's confined to my phone. And I'm like, why can I not just watch this on my TV? Why isn't this an hour-long drama? I'd rather just watch it that way.
It's very weird. Like, I was trying to watch, you know, some clips of things with my wife, and, like, there is no AirPlay support. There's no Chromecast support. They're really, really going all in with this mobile video concept, almost in a way that seems punishing and restrictive. And this just makes me think that mobile video in general, right, is, it doesn't make sense. Like, mobile video as its own thing, it doesn't make sense because we're watching content across all sorts of screens. We want flexibility, you know, we want the ability to, like, start watching something on YouTube, maybe throw it to our TV, maybe use the YouTube app on our TV, use our phone for other things. Like, there's a freedom I think consumers expect, and Quibi just doesn't have that, because you also can't juggle watching a show and then go chat with your friends or something, right? Like, it's so inflexible.
Yeah, I mean, I think the slight caveat I would add is that you and I are both men of a certain age, and certainly sure. know, younger viewers, I think, like, we grew up watching television. Like, that was how we watched. And I think younger people grew up, there's going to be a generation of people who grew up watching things primarily on their phones, maybe on their tablets and laptops, but primarily on their phones. But I think even them, they don't care what the screen is on. The phone, they watch things on their phone because it's convenient. If there's a bigger, better screen, they still want to watch it on that. Quibi might add that in the future, but it is a real, like, hamper on the experience right now.
It does feel like, the argument for Quibi is like, oh yeah, look at these youths. Look at these young people who are always on their phones. Let's provide them some high quality content on their phones. And, you know, I've talked to people in this generation. Certainly most people have not heard of Quibi. And just looking at the way younger folks use their phones, it's like, yeah, they watch it. They watch stuff on their phones, but also the idea of paying, even if it's $5 a month for something that's ad supported, for something that doesn't have any, like, truly compelling content. Like, the magic of YouTube, the magic of Netflix and other things is that there's so much content. There's kind of a freedom to it in terms of how you consume it. Quibi just doesn't have that. I don't think it could eventually. But I'm also, we haven't talked about, like, the key technology, which is what they're using to try to differentiate themselves. It's called Turnstile. It lets you sort of watch the video in portrait or landscape mode, depending on your mood or whatever you're feeling, and it'll appropriately crop or fit the camera to that view. They actually shoot it both ways, which I think is a really interesting idea. I don't think you can build a whole service around that one concept.
Yeah, I think there's definitely some internal speculation at TechCrunch about whether or not Quibi ultimately is just selling this technology to other video companies, and that's the ultimate business model. We'll see. I think when people hear about Turnstile, or sometimes even when they see it, they're a little underwhelmed because rotating your phone is not that big a deal. But it is probably the best experience I've had flipping between two different, you know, orientations on my phone. I think it works really well. It, in some ways, it's sort of subtle and you know, kind of hard to see what's impressive about it, but it works well.
I would honestly bet that Quibi feels like something that they're building just to sell it off really quick, and not just for Turnstile, but also for the content and the talent and everybody involved. Like, they've produced a ton of content, so I could see Disney or somebody down the line being like, hey, we need a quick and easy service that we could, you know, maybe open it up somehow and make that work. I saw a demo of Turnstile at CES where they could also use it for interactivity. So it was the one of the short movies coming up called Wireless. And in landscape view, you could see the character, you know, in a normal frame, just staring at their phone. And when you turn to portrait, you see what's actually on their phone. So it's kind of an interesting, like, multi-angle approach to things. I found that fascinating, but they only have, yeah, that one movie coming up this year. They haven't really talked about any others, and they've, like, made one demo showing off the tech. I don't know if people are going to go through the effort of setting that up. It's cool, but it's also, like, gamified in a way. And also, you don't need Turnstile to make that happen. Like, multi-angle gaming... that interactive gaming like that has been happening for a while, maybe just not as seamlessly, but we have technology for that already.
It's hard to tell because I think in the beginning days of any medium, right, there's going to be a lot of experimentation and a lot of gimmicks. I think the example a lot of people use is, you know, early films where it's like the train coming just straight at the camera and people are like, oh my God. And so, you know, if Turnstile turns out to be at least a part of the future video, it probably won't look anything like these early experiments, but you're just going to see a lot of gimmicky stuff at the beginning. And that's maybe interesting, but not sustainable.
And I will say for listeners, if you want to get my full feelings on Quibi, go read my review, because it's one of those things that as I tested it, it made me more and more infuriated. Like, some of the content is fine. It looks good. It's perfectly fine. I don't understand how they've raised so much money for something that's so, like, inessential, in like not very flexible, not very interesting. I think it was really dismantled that kind of broke me. The idea of watching a show where, you know, a show hosted by Tytus Burgess, it's like 5 minutes long per episode. They get random cooks, blindfold them, throw food at them, make them eat the food off the floors and the walls, and then they have to like recreate the meal from based on that taste. I don't know. It felt like some weird dystopian Black Mirror content to me that just, it didn't work at all. And then the fact that I couldn't even throw it to my TV, I couldn't do anything, just felt like a boondoggle to me. I can't imagine like anybody else doing this. Like, if you didn't have Jeffrey Katzenberg's name, if you didn't get this much funding, I don't know if we'd be taking it as seriously at all. Like, this would just be another Go 90, you know, which is Verizon's failed attempt at mobile video, which I'm just looking around here for the snipers. It probably died a little too soon, right? It was just too good for this world. By the way, what is up with mobile video startups not knowing how to name themselves? So Go 90 was named after you turning your phone. You're going 90 degrees to watch mobile video and landscape. As the kids say, you go 90, right? Right, Anthony?
I do think that Quibi has a little more going for it than Go 90 did, but they both seem to have the same basic mindset of, you know, older executive saying, yes, the kids like mobile video. Let's figure out what we can do with that.
It's like Mr. Burns trying to create his own like TV network or something. It's like, what are the children up to? Excellent. Mobile video. What does Quibi stand for, by the way? Quick bites. Quick bites. Quick bites of content.
Again, bad, but not as bad as Go 90.
Just to say something nice about Quibi, I did like Most Dangerous Game, like from what I saw of it. But it was also like, man, this looks like a highly produced action, you know, thriller starring Christoph Waltz and Liam Hemsworth. I want to see this on my TV. I can't. I'm stuck staring at it on my phone. So I'm constantly frustrated by what is going on. Anthony, anything good like that you truly enjoyed? I guess you liked Chrissy Teigen's show, right?
I did. I would also say, I mean, Most Dangerous Game was to me the most promising because it did feel like almost like the cold open of a traditional TV show, like just lays out the premise. It's very intriguing, has a little element of class rage, which feels very appropriate right now. So I'm very curious to see what's going on there. I also really liked Flipped, the Will Forte show that I mentioned. It seemed like, again, it's compressed well into a 7 or 8 minute segment. I laughed out loud several times.
What exactly is Flipped? Like, what's the concept?
It is basically Will Forte is a high school drama teacher who's just been fired. His wife is a faux Home Depot employee who's just been fired. They decide to start to audition for one of these home renovation TV shows.
Okay. Sounds fascinating. Talk about like home reno. Like there is the murder house flip show, which, yes, that looks like, or it sounds like something they would have pitched on 30 Rock, and not even something like a smart character would have pitched, like something Tracy Morgan would have pitched on 30 Rock. You know, it seems like we're scraping the bottom of the barrel here quite a bit. Any further thoughts on Quibi or where it's headed, Anthony?
I think my last thought is just, if it's going to succeed, it will look, and I'm not confident that, well, I think it has a chance at success just because they've got so much money and so many talented people who've signed up, that even if it's this initial launch doesn't do that well, they can kind of limp along for a while and maybe they'll figure something out. If it succeeds, it'll look completely different from what we see at launch this week. Mm-hmm. I think their other advantage is there are people on the team who know that, who understand that this is going to be a process of experimentation and iterating. We'll see if they get there.
Yeah. I get a sense, just I haven't talked to the talent, but I see a lot of people who are just like, you're raising $1 billion for this? Okay, I'll be on your dumb show. I'll pitch this dumb thing. Like a lot of people just seem like, okay, this is free-flowing money. I'm just going to make a dumb thing and maybe it succeeds, maybe it won't. Who knows? Let's move on to my interview with Alex Garland, the creator of Devs, the guy behind, he wrote 28 Days Later. He wrote the Never Let Me Go adaptation. He recently directed Annihilation and Ex Machina, which I also interviewed him for at Engadget. So that was a really fun interview several years ago. Now he's back with a show that is truly wild, truly like a very different sort of bit of sci-fi. So check out our chat. Hi, Alex.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well. Thank you so much for taking time to chat. So I'm just thinking about like what you've accomplished with Devs. With Ex Machina, it seemed like you were exploring the ideas of consciousness, human and machine consciousness. Now you're jumping to quantum computing and free will and determinism. What was the impetus for exploring that in a TV series like this?
Well, in the terms of this interview, can I ask, is it... Mm-hmm. Do spoilers matter?
That's a good question. Well, we're up to episode 4 now here in the US, so I think you can mention up to that. Definitely, well, let's try to keep things surprising for the end. Yeah.
I guess the way I see it is that actually Devs is like a companion piece to Ex Machina. Mm-hmm. They're sort of related in a way, the two projects. And I'm trying to think how I can talk without getting I had a set of concerns, some of which were cross-related to Ex Machina, mm-hmm. and some of which are just sort of discrete to Devs. And with Devs, it was triggered by this concept of determinism and trying to present a couple of interpretations of quantum mechanics, which sounds like a sort of inherently complex statement, but it isn't really. So. And then there were some other concerns which were to do with the nature of the sort of specific nature of some of the tech companies in terms of power and the kind of power they take for themselves and also the power that we confer onto them. And in some ways, it's in that area that the sort of that the cross-relation with Ex Machina.
Gotcha. And what is it about quantum mechanics and also quantum computing that's really, you know, tickled your interest here? Because it is something we hear about. We hear about, you know, the advances Google and other companies have made in quantum computing. I feel like most people don't know what that means, you know, in the grander scheme of things. But it sounded like you had ideas where this could eventually end up.
The thing that interested me about quantum computers was a specific... idea, which is that up to this point we've had binary computers, but we appear to live in a quantum mechanical mm-hmm. world, and so what you get is binary computers attempting to emulate the conditions of quantum mechanics in their modeling systems. And if you had a quantum computer working in a quantum mechanical way, right. You then have a quantum mechanical system attempting to model a quantum mechanical system. So you might be able to model it in a much truer and more accurate way.
Gotcha. And it's, you know, I have to think, like, this is Amaya, the tech company in this, in the series, does seem like one of those, like, Uber Googles, like, just a large company and you don't know all the little things they do. We also don't really get a sense of like the other things Amaya does beyond the really cool quantum mechanic stuff. Like, what is Amaya to you? Are they something where we're on all their social networks? Are they something that pervades our lives the way Facebook and Google does?
I saw them as a manufacturer of quantum computer systems. Mm-hmm. So maybe, you know, maybe like the early days of some of the hardware companies before they expanded into software as well. And if you did have a company that was mass producing powerful quantum computers or making them just available to various parts of the industry or the government or whoever it was, you'd have a very, very new bit of kit that in really base terms would just be earning that company a hell of a lot of money. So I saw it as like being sort of representative of the way these tech companies can explode out of nowhere if they have a breakthrough that is specific to them. You know, they corner the market in whatever it happens to be. It could be they corner the market in home delivery, you know, or it could be in a chip that lots of other systems use, like NVIDIA or whatever it happens to be. So I guess I just saw Amaya as the maker and manufacturer, but also as the maker and manufacturer, also the people that are best placed to exploit the system. So they're trying search engines and AIs and encryption systems that are based around their quantum computers rather than the ones that everybody else uses.
Gotcha. Do you have a sense of like what would people be buying these systems for? What do you think a government or other people would be doing? My mind was kind of racing just imagining the world building of the world of devs, and I hope we get to see more of that at some point. But in your mind, how does that build out?
It's a really interesting question, that, because I have spoken to people who say not much in a lot of areas. Mm-hmm. Like quantum computing isn't actually going to be that helpful in lots of parts of life, essentially because a binary computer does everything as well as you would want it to do. And so why do you need a system that can work in the way that a quantum computer does? And it was actually partly while thinking about that led me to a bit of writing, which was talking about a quantum computer's ability to model quantum states, quantum mechanical states. And that partly was the trigger. I think that the actual practical uses of these things, people aren't really sure what they'll be using.
Right. I think it's that that uncertainty that is both kind of interesting and scary to me. When we talked about Ex Machina, I brought up the idea of the killer AI, the killer robots that so many people seem afraid of. I'm almost more afraid of what we could accomplish with these, quantum computers that we don't know what exactly they'll unearth and how exactly they'll work. Is that something you've been, thinking on? And how did you draw the line between quantum computing and like determinism and thinking about cracking the code of reality, basically?
You don't need quantum computers or binary computers or any kind of computers really to start puzzling over determinism and to end up creating quite a strong argument for it. And in a way, the argument is best made by showing how easy it would be to disprove. Because if you found something in the universe that completely spontaneously and randomly popped into existence, then you would have disproved determinism completely. Right. If you came up with something that wasn't in some ways relating to cause and effect, then the theory's blown to bits. And then and it's the difficulty with finding something as simple as that that becomes the strength of the argument. And that doesn't require any kind of computing at all to have that thought process, if you see what I mean. What I did think, though, was that if a quantum computer was as good at modeling quantum reality as it might be, then it would be able to prove in a definitive way whether we lived in a deterministic state or not. And that seems to me to be something that would be interesting to prove and kind of worth proving, because it would completely change the way we look at ourselves, the way we look at society, the way society functions, the way relationships unfold and develop, and So I guess that was the train of thought.
Gotcha. Is there, I have to ask, do you have your own thoughts about that at this point? Like, are you fully prepared for the argument that, oh, yes, we completely live in a deterministic world? Or are you just kind of interested in where we head with that stuff? Because to me, it almost seems like, as somebody who's studied philosophy for a while, too, if we do end up with this idea that, yeah, everything is predetermined, free will doesn't exist, I feel like that would also break the perception of reality for a lot of people. I'm just wondering where you stand.
It would in some ways, but then it would restructure itself pretty quickly, I think. My own leaning as a sort of interested layperson is that I suspect this is deterministic and we don't have free will. That's my that's my gut feeling. But philosophically and emotionally, in many ways, it doesn't change that much, because whether or not you or I have free will, both of us could identify lots of things that we care about, lots of things that we enjoy or don't enjoy, or things that we're scared of, right, or things that we anticipate. And all of that remains. It's not remotely affected by whether we've got free will or not. What might be affected is, I think, our capacity to be forgiving in some respects. And so certain kinds of antisocial or criminal behavior, you would start to think about in terms of rehabilitation rather than punishment, because in a way, there's no point punishing someone for something they didn't decide to do. But you might want to alter their behavior to mean that they didn't do it in the future. Mm-hmm. You could also then say with some people, well, we've identified that this person is not ever going to be rehabilitatable, and so we would imprison them forever and throw away the key or whatever. but whatever the sort of philosophical thought process was, we'd have to in some respect start again and change the way we think about guilt and responsibility, and therefore blame, you know. And the thing about that is that, unlike a lot of these things, which often work in a counterintuitive way. So science or philosophy presents something and you think, that in no way is how I thought the world
worked.
I think that particular idea to do with determinism actually dovetails quite closely with our experience of how the world works, because it's very often the case that, say, if someone does something that makes us angry, the more we understand about that person, the less angry we get. And that would be a very broad rule, and it would be quite easy to find exceptions, but still, in broad terms, it would remain true, you know? So in some ways, it feels allied to our experience, even though, bizarrely, it's counterintuitively, in fact, it seems counterintuitive, but actually it's not counterintuitive.
Yeah, I like the way you're thinking about that. And honestly, I've appreciated that about all your work. It seems like you come up with you have a key idea, a key really interesting idea, and you try to dive into it. I can imagine for you getting a complex story like this told, was it easier for you doing this through Hulu and effects in a TV limited series format than something like Annihilation, which is a movie I loved, but it was not treated well by the studios.
It was just an entirely different experience from start to end. I had no creative restrictions. I only had creative support. And then when the project was delivered, they were happy with it, and that just is not normally my working life. TV has different rules and paradigms, and television, as far as I can tell, is not as concerned with something equivalent to the box office weekend. They're okay with the idea of something building slowly, and maybe as well, I hope. It's like, it doesn't also just reduce the viewing figures. There may be other reasons why a company might want to make something, in as much as that when you make film, you're making a product, and when you make TV, you're not the product, the station is the product, and you are a bit of branding in some respects on the product. So they've got different imperatives.
Gotcha. I've heard that explanation too. I think Lulu Wang, who directed The Farewell, described it exactly like that, and that's why she didn't go with Netflix. Went with the traditional studio approach. But I think that worked better for, you know, a self-contained film like this. I can't imagine a show like this being on a traditional, you know, broadcast network in the US, but something like Hulu and a maybe more risky, a network that is familiar with taking risks like FX. It seems like they're down for these ideas.
It was made for FX.
Yeah, yeah.
But for what it's worth, it was made for FX. At the time they started making it, at the time they financed it, the Disney deal wasn't happening. Mm-hmm. The Hulu project wasn't. You know, FX on Hulu wasn't a thing. All of that came quite late in the day. So it was, initially, it was just for John Landgraf.
Gotcha. But yeah, here in the US, FX is still kind of a premium channel. So we look at that as like, oh yeah, that's where you see something like, The Americans on AMC. You know, this is premium TV and not just like broadcast TV. So I think within the rules of premium TV, you certainly have a lot of room to maneuver and tell a really creative story like this. Is this a medium you kind of would want to explore more moving forward?
I'd like to. I think that always with these things, your ability to keep working is in some ways defined by whatever's happened previously.
Right.
You
know? Right.
And so I never take it as a given that I'll be able to actually work anywhere. but I would like to do this again. I've got an idea which I've started writing, which is also structured as an 8-part television show, to do with FX again. Mm-hmm. And so if everything works out, then that's what I'll do next. But if life teaches us anything, it's don't take anything for granted. So it's a hope rather than a certainty.
Most definitely. Can you give us any hints about what this next idea is, or even not that, like any other big ideas you'd like to tackle? Because it seems like simulation theory would be an interesting one for you. And I don't know, the human response to the global pandemic that we're all living through. Seems like you've got a lot to explore these days.
Well, we all do, mm-hmm. I guess, don't we? There's a lot going on. The next thing I'm going to try to do is actually political, and it's not science fiction.
Okay.
It's really about civil disobedience, really, and the supposed sense that I had that we used to be better at civil disobedience, mm-hmm. maybe something like that. But in terms of the other sort of big ideas that are out there, I mean, you can hardly move without falling over a big idea.
Right,
you
right.
know? We're just like, we're surrounded by them. I think that years and years ago, I did a movie set in space, and one day I'd really love to go back and try and do that again.
Oh, I would love to see that too. Well, thank you so much. Good luck with, I'm sure you're going to be talking to a lot of people, but I hope people watch Devs. It seems like it's doing pretty well from the responses to our articles about it and everything.
Well, cool, man. And nice to speak to you
again.
Yeah,
good to chat. All right, have a good one. So, Anthony, what are you working on these days? What's next on your plate?
Well, I think like a lot of news publications, especially tech news publications, it feels like what exactly our coverage area is evolves mm-hmm. every week. Because you can't ignore what's happening, this giant thing that's happening in the world, and it's affecting everything, including the tech world. And I think the main way that's manifested for me is that I was doing a series of interviews with digital media executives, like people at BuzzFeed, at Bustle Digital Group, and a number of other publications, about just sort of their overall strategy, their plans for 2020. In between doing the interviews and publishing them, the whole world changed. And so now I'm sort of in the process of trying to adapt and update these interviews so that they reflect the world we live in now, because I think we are in the middle of a very, very uncertain time for everyone, including publications that make most of their money from advertising.
Yeah, definitely. It's a scary time for all of us. Didn't you? And Bustle just killed off at least one site, which is very sad.
Right. They shut down the Outline, or they were very insistent to me that it's not necessarily shut down permanently, but it is. They've laid off all of the staff and it's on pause right now. They also laid off a number of other team members. I think, you know, we're going to see more layoffs, more pay cuts kind of across the industry. It's going to be a pretty scary and stressful time.
Yep, for everybody. It's not a great time. So here, I will try to avoid the bad times. So I'm currently looking at two Asus laptops right now, the Zephyrus G14, which is, I've seen a lot written about this machine already. It's one of the first gaming laptops to be powered by AMD's new Ryzen processors. It's very exciting for nerds like me. And, you know, I hope, even though this is a very stressful time, I hope, like, people can still get their hands on these products. I hope, like, we can keep this this whole cycle of new things happening, because there is a lot being delayed. We don't know if even the freaking game consoles at the end of the year are going to be a thing. So it all seems kind of frivolous in the grand scheme of things right now. But for the tech world, and I think, I don't know, the tech industry as a whole, I'm hoping, like, we keep these things running as easily as we can. Anthony, do you have any picks, like, things that are keeping you happy in this dark time?
Yeah. One of the things I've been talking about with a lot of my friends and coworkers is the fact that as something like an actual apocalypse seems to be unfolding around us, there's something comforting about experiencing fictional apocalypses, at least for I think for some of us. And so one of the things this has prompted me to do is finally sign up for Apple Arcade. And I've been playing a lot of Overland, which is a strategy game where you're driving across the country trying to avoid a bunch of killer aliens. At least I assume they're aliens. And it is extremely stressful. I'm not a huge gamer, so like there are probably people for whom this is a very easy game. It's not for me. I keep like screaming profanity at my iPad and my
girlfriend. I will say it's a rough game on you, Anthony. Like, I play a lot of strategy games, and even that game is extra like harsh. You can just be wiped out all of a sudden. But yeah, it's a tactics style apocalyptic game. That's cool.
Yeah, exactly. But it does feel like a really nice escape to be worrying about killer aliens rather than other things.
Yeah, something you can actually run away from or kill if you needed to. Yeah,
exactly.
I've got a couple things. One thing I've noticed, just because I'm in a weird place, my apartment is right below Prospect Park, and right now that there aren't that many humans outside, there aren't as many cars outside, it sounds like a goddamn forest in my neighborhood. I have a little deck, I go outside, and all I hear are birds and lots of chirping, which is certainly preferable to the constant ambulance sirens as well. So there's that. I would suggest just go listen to what the world looks like outside right now, because it is a weird thing where most of society is shut down. There aren't as many people outside. And in many, I've seen reports, like in LA, I think the big cats are just coming out to play. I've seen in other areas around the world, like the animals that normally hide and stay, you know, in the woods or something are coming out. We are almost getting to like I Am Legend levels of wildlife taking back society. I don't know. It's both depressing, but also a really interesting thing to hear. And I've also been checking out High Fidelity on Hulu, which is a remake of the John Cusack movie, which I'm not a fan of that movie, as like, I think indicative it was of, I don't know, a lot of the hipster friends I knew at the time. I was never a fan of that movie because I don't know about your feelings, Anthony, but he always really came across as like a huge sexist asshole in that movie. So I didn't really have anything to hang on. This show is a reboot starring Zoe Kravitz. She is once again a record store owner named Rob in New York, which is, I guess, kind of an anachronistic thing these days. But the show, I think it's really interesting. She is a great actor. And even though her character is also a jerk in the same way, I think it is... I know it's more interesting because it's not just a guy being a misogynist. I think there's a lot more going on there. So there's that. Have you seen High Fidelity, either the original or the reboot, Anthony?
I've seen the original many times and watched it. In fact, actually, that was one of the things that bonded me to one of your college friends, our mutual friend, Leon Tu. And I sort of see it as a marker of my personal growth that at the time in high school, John Cusack's character seemed aspirational, and that is no longer the case. I am really excited to see the Zoe Kravitz version. I just haven't made time for it yet.
Yeah, the movie was this really interesting. It also starred Jack Black, but it was kind of an exploration of like your taste in media and your curation of the arts is more important to you than your personality or how you treat people. And that's not how I want to go through life, even though I do care quite a bit about what we're watching, and I will make fun of Sherlyn whenever I can for what she watches. Never go full John Cusack, please.
That's a good general marker in life. Don't be that guy.
Don't be that guy. Also, especially after his tweets this week, cancel, please. All right, that's it for the show this week. Thank you for joining us, Anthony.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You could find Anthony online. Where can we find you?
I'm on Twitter at Anthony Ha, and you just Google Anthony Ha TechCrunch, and you'll get a whole list of my articles.
Cool. And you can find me online at Devendra. I'm on Twitter there. Find me chatting about movies and TV at the /filmcast at /film.com. We just reviewed Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which is a freaking masterpiece. So that's on Hulu right now. Just go look at that movie. Go look at something beautiful. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify. And we are out.